The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You know, getting that insight into somebody really, truly trying, you know, and perhaps succeeding to break in gives you some real scenarios on how could this actually happen instead of just guessing at it. It's funny to hear people talk about all these really advanced exploitation techniques or advanced, methods of breaking into these networks. It's been my experience, being involved in this, that the bulk majority of serious security compromises are actually laughably stupid. They're really, really bad. I mean, bad passwords, ancient software, passwords reused in 1,000 different places. It's in some cases, a lot of these hacks are not as complicated as you think they would be. And certainly, like penetration testing and bug bounty type programs can really help you find a lot of that low-hanging fruit very quickly, but certainly some of the more complex attacks, too.
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 13th, 2016. That was the voice of Daniel Plasek that you just heard, formerly one of the key figures behind the underground hacker website Dark Code. Last week, at the University of Texas at Austin's Strauss Center, Plasek offered an inside look into what led him to start Dark Code, which Europol once called the most prolific English-speaking cybercriminal forum to date, the types of hacker tools available for hire on the site, and what the future of the dark web looks like. Plasek also discusses his cooperation with federal law enforcement officials and their efforts to take down the site. It's an interview that shines light into some of the darkest corners of the web and raises fundamental questions about how such places are policed. NPR News correspondent Dina Temple-Raston moderated the discussion. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 157, Daniel Plasek on Dark Code.
So Daniel was one of the original coders of Dark Code. He helped pull it together. So what we thought we would do during this lunch is we talk a little bit about how he got to that point, what he did, how he got caught, and where things are for him now, and maybe cover some of the issues that we touched on from a technical perspective yesterday, touch on them a little bit more from a guy who actually knows, for example, how botnets work. And so I guess I wanted to start with just sort of how you knew you were talented in this way. How did you know that you were good at coding? Give us an idea of what Daniel Plasek at 13 was like, which wasn't that long ago for you. So 13, what was that like?
Come on. I
mean, okay, you're 27. It was a little while ago.
Yeah. I think, like a lot of young men, boys, I first became interested in computers because of games, video games. Got started on that on my parents' Mac computer back in the 90s. And
and it was in the basement?
No, not at that point. Okay. That comes later.
Okay.
And pretty quickly, I became very interested in, how does this game work? What goes on behind the scenes? What are the pieces? And some of my first kind of dabbling in programming and I guess maybe what you'd even call some hacking is kind of playing around with these games, cheating at games, if you will, and changing the games. So that was some of my first kind of dabbling in that.
So to make your score better, what is this? Or Warcraft? Is that, what were you playing?
Well, Age of Empires, but very, very similar to Warcraft, yes, but...
And you'd hack into it to make your character be able to do something different or to do something better? Or
yeah, you know, get additional resources in the game, that type of thing. So.
And was this sort of like playing the piano that you found you were getting better and better at it? Or was this more like it was a puzzle for you to solve?
Yeah, I mean, definitely feels like a puzzle. And, you know, I didn't really, you know, play with that for very long. That very quickly, you know, sparked an interest in programming, you know, so the tools you kind of use to create some of this stuff. You know, one of the very first languages I dabbled in, Paul was actually talking about earlier today, is Python, which is very popular now. It wasn't so much back then, but I started dabbling with that in my early teens.
And you taught yourself that, or you did that at high school?
Yeah. My programming skills and to be honest, most of my IT-related skills are self-taught. I spend a great deal of time reading. You know, unfortunately, you know, for someone who is really interested in programming and some of these deeper technical topics, there's just not a lot for you in you know, middle school and even to a certain extent high school. You know, I don't think it was until high school that I was even in a position where programming classes were even available. And by the time I got there, I was pretty significantly past the, you know, what I could get out of those classes, unfortunately.
And there wasn't somebody, and I would assume that you were sort of past what most of the teachers themselves knew by that time.
I'd like to think so. Maybe that's arrogant of me to say so, but it certainly felt that way at the time, yes.
So you're playing these games. Are you up all night doing this instead of your homework? Or, you know, is this a computer in your room? Is it down in the basement? Give us an idea.
I mean, initially, no, I didn't have my own computer. Later, I did. Certainly, my habits, both you know, video gaming and you know, programming and hacking and whatnot, has made me a more nocturnal person. I think that's true of a lot of IT people, though. But I never did particularly well with the structured environment of school. I'm sure given the amount of people who teach in this room, they're familiar with that problem. But yeah, you know, I was never very good at getting my homework done, and you know, this obsession almost with computers and with programming and consumed a lot of my thought.
And so, how did you get involved with other people first through sort of gaming together, or how did you progress towards hacking?
Yeah, you know, gaming actually was, you know, kind of my gateway into that. You know, later on, you know, in my teens, I was playing a game called Counter-Strike. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that. It's a you know, first-person shooter type game, very popular. And back then, you know, one of the ways you could speak to other people who play the game or find other people to play with was something called IRC, or Internet Relay Chat. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that, but it's a very...
How many of you are familiar with IRC? Okay. It's people in the back.
Well, for those that aren't, it's a very, very old kind of Internet chat system, been around for a very long time. It's very simple, but still in use to this day, actually. There were some chat networks dedicated to you know, gaming, and so I was on there for that reason, and... That's where I had kind of my first encounters with people you might call hackers. You know, in particular, the people I met on there were people running botnets. And
could you explain? We had sort of a technical explanation, I guess, or a very vague definition of a botnet yesterday. Could you explain your understanding of a botnet and why it attracted you? Why you thought botnets were cool?
Sure. At a high level, a botnet is a collection of machines that are being, you know, controlled, you know, centrally by someone and used for a lot of purposes. Of course, denial of service, collecting information from those devices, whether that's passwords or credit card numbers, things like that. You know, usually, most commonly, it's comprised of Windows computers, you know, people's Windows desktops, laptops, but I've certainly seen some more exotic ones as well, ones that are comprised of network routers even. That kind of thing is out there. But back then, it was definitely, really Windows computers was the target. Mac, it's not really relevant, didn't have the market share then, so that was the focus.
Do you remember your first botnet, how big it was, who was doing it?
Yeah, so the first person that kind of introduced me to this, he was running a botnet that had somewhere in the vicinity of 1,000 bots in it. And when I say 1,000, I mean 1,000 kind of online at the same time. So that's not necessarily representative of the total number of computers he had infected, but at any one moment, at least around 1,000 of those were turned on and part of the botnet. So I guess in absolute, it may have been a bit bigger than that. And at the time, that was stunning to me. Wow, this guy's got control of 1,000 computers. That's incredible. What is the technology that drives this? How is he doing this? And of course, now 1,000 is nothing. It's a drop in the bucket, but it was very impressive to me back then.
And did he sort of say, I have these 1,000 computers that I have control over, and this is what I can make them do, and sort of showed you? And what was that like? What could they do?
Yeah. My first kind of introduction to this, I guess, was, some of the things that he was doing were a lot more petty, kind of the little denial of service. Somebody irritated me in a game, and I'm going to knock them offline, and, you can use bots, on IRC to, like, flood chat channels, so send lots of messages and kind of be abusive on the chat program online, so there's some of that going on, so, kind of childish hijinks, if you will, was kind of my first introduction to it. This wasn't a guy who was, harvesting Social Security numbers and impersonating people.
He was just bugging people, mostly.
Yeah.
Right. So one of the analogies we used in the Radiolab piece was that it was a little bit like you were in control of the ball, and you could take the ball away and stop the game. Is that how it felt?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a good analogy. And I think, a lot of, the people who use denial of service is everyone familiar with that term, by the way, before I keep using it, denial of service?
Yeah.
Okay. It's a way to have control. It's power, and certainly that can feel good to have that kind of power, and especially as someone young who did not feel like they had a lot of control in their life. That had a certain attraction to it.
And did you, so were you like 15 or 16 by this time? And did you recognize that's what was attractive? Or was it more of a intellectual sort of pull?
A little bit of both. I mean, I think I'd be lying if I said it wasn't a little bit of both. I think the initial kind of glamour of, wow, here's these cool things you can do may be what kind of caught my attention, but very quickly for me, I became very interested in the underlying technology, the software that drives all this, and that really became an obsession for me.
You talked about studying malicious code to sort of train yourself in programming. Can you talk a little bit about that? What did that mean?
Yeah, so, in these communities, online, there's, of course, a lot of buy, sell, trade, if you will, of the various tools of the trade, and sometimes you can buy malware that's kind of pre-made and easy to use, but you can also, in a lot of cases, buy like the source code for malware, the code that underpins it. And in addition to buying and selling it, of course, there's a fair amount of botnet type code that's just out there and available. People trade it, pass it around. To be honest, you can even Google it and find some of it for yourself if you want to read that code. And so I spent quite a bit of time early on kind of just reading through that code and going through it line by line, trying to understand, what is this? What am I looking at? What is this doing? And even spent a fair amount of time, experimenting myself, against my own computer. Let me change this little thing, recompile it, and run it, and see what happens. So,
And what's a specific example of that for those of us who don't code? When you wanted to change something on your computer, what did you change?
Well, I mean, I was experimenting, you know, with changes to the code, like adding features or changing features, you know, whether that's the ability to grab files from that computer or some different type of denial of service, you know, that kind of thing.
Okay. So let's fast forward to sort of the early days of dark code. Can you talk about how dark code started? I mean, it didn't start in your mind as this sort of bizarre for hackers. It started out as something quite different. Can you talk about that?
No, it was very different. So, you know, after, you know, being involved in this for a little while, I had a number of, I don't know what I want to call them, internet acquaintances. And, you know, one of them was someone that I knew by Iserdo, I-S-E-R-D-O. I think his real name has since been revealed, and I believe he currently resides in a prison. But
in a foreign country?
Yeah, I think he's from Ukraine or one of the Eastern European countries. But in any case, he was like me in a lot of ways. He was very into the programming aspect of it. He had quite a bit of success, much more than me, selling his code. In any case, we kind of talked shop quite a bit, talked programming, and one day we decided, well, let's start a little community, kind of an invite-only thing, where we can get some like-minded people together and really just talk code. You know, we don't want all the script kiddies, people who are just using these tools but don't really understand them. You know, let's get the people who are really making this stuff and understand it.
Have you heard the term script kiddie before? No. Can you explain what a script kiddie is?
Yeah, so...
I'm not one. Yeah.
There's a lot of different labels that people apply to kind of the broad category of hackers, and hackers apply to each other. Script kiddie is kind of a derogatory term for somebody who's kind of a wannabe hacker, if you will. You know, they can use the tools and do some things, but they don't really know what they're doing or understand how the stuff works.
So they're posers.
Yeah, they're posers.
Okay. So you wanted to create sort of a clubhouse for non-posers? Was that the idea?
That was the goal initially. I unfortunately chose the name. I've seen it pronounced "dark ode," which wasn't actually the original intention. It was a play on words like dark code, like coding programming. So.
It's spelled D-A-R-K-O-D-E.
So.
And K was your idea.
Certainly was.
And it sounded more sinister, or what was the idea?
It sounded cool at the time.
Okay.
I can't justify it now.
But, still sounds cool.
So we started it up and invited a few people that we already knew. You know, chatting about code, sharing a little bit of code, you know, people...
Was it on Tor? Was it on the Onion Router at that time? Or is this before that? Or?
You know, I don't know if that was pre-Tor or not. I mean, this was 2008, I believe. No, it was not on Tor. To be honest with you, it was pretty brazen. I mean, it was publicly available site. You certainly couldn't just browse it and read the content. I mean, you had to have an account, which you had to have an invite for, so there was that. But it was open, you know, on the internet. It wasn't on Tor.
And so let's say in the first couple of months that it was running, how many people were actually part of it?
Pretty small number. You know, I couldn't give you an exact count, but I think, you know, less than 25 initially. It was a pretty small group. And that kind of, I mean, that grew over a few months. I think day one it was like five people or something like that. And, grew to 25, you know, or so over the next few months.
And would you swap coding problems that you had, or what does it mean to talk code?
Yeah, I mean, we'd talk about the projects we were working on, talk about ideas, you know, talk about some of the different technologies. You know, back then, one of the things that we discussed quite a bit was kind of the P2P, the peer-to-peer technologies for running botnets. So at that time, you know, most all botnets were centrally controlled. You had, you know, one or a few servers that controlled it all. And, you know, certainly from a simplicity standpoint, there's a lot of advantages to that. It's very easy to understand and program for that design. But, you know, from a reliability standpoint and from a law enforcement standpoint, there's obviously some real disadvantages to centralizing all that. So there was a lot of discussion back then around P2P and how we could leverage that. That wasn't really realized, you know, while I was still doing this, but certainly in the years since now, it has been realized.
And so these botnets that you guys were controlling, what were you having them do? Was it had clearly gone from taking your football to doing something else. What was the something else?
Yeah, I mean, at that point, you know, me personally, I was not running botnets at that point. I was really just doing the programming side of it, you know, for people who were. So kind of a partnership in that way. You know, I fortunately or unfortunately, I guess depending on how you want to look at it, never really had the business skills to go with this. You know, I made an embarrassingly small amount of money for the amount of risk I took on here. So
would someone go on just to explain this? So someone would go on and say, hey, if you can fix this problem I'm having with my botnet, I'll give you $50 or I'll give you $100. Is that?
It wasn't so much that. It was more of a, you know, hey, I want a bot that does this specific set of tasks. Can you do that? Or I have this piece of code already, but I need, you know, 5 additional features. Can you kind of fill in the blanks here? More like that.
And what's an example of 5 additional features?
Well, I mean, these bots have a lot of features. I never really dealt with kind of software that does some of the spying stuff that we were talking about, you know, like webcams, and maybe this is going to sound silly coming from someone branded as a hacker, but that always to me felt a little bit too invasive. It's you know, easier to not think about kind of the people in this equation. You know, it's over the internet and you're dealing with computers and you don't see people that you're harming. You know, it's not like you're mugging someone or breaking into someone's home. So, I mean, that's something that I kind of shied away from. And but in any case, back to your question, you know, some of the most basic features are you know, kind of reporting some system information. You know, what is this computer? What kind of hardware does it have? Where is it? You know, what country is it in? That's some important information. There's a lot of in the kind of the bot herder world. There's different value assigned to bots in different countries. Just for example, infected computers in China are very low value. Almost nobody's really interested in that. They don't have a lot of you know, useful data on them. They don't have quite as good internet connections as other places. There's not a lot of you know, to get out of it there. Ones in the U.S. are generally the most highly valued, as I'm sure no one's surprised to learn. So that was useful. The other most basic feature, I mean, that pretty much all of these has, is the ability to update themselves, or maybe even more importantly, to install other software. So a lot of the people who run these botnets, you know, one of the big sources of income for them is actually kind of selling the access to those computers, you know, installing other people's software, whether that's another botnet or, you know, perhaps ad software, you know, pop-ups, that kind of thing.
Spam
bots. That's another avenue.
And so talk a little bit about Dark Code's progression. You came out of it in 2009 or 2010?
Yeah, somewhere in 2009, I believe. I don't know the exact date, but I became uninvolved in it, you know, probably, you know, around a year after it was created. But a few months in, you know, it became apparent that there was a desire to kind of bring in some, I guess what I would call buyers. You know, we had these people who were creating things, and, you know, some of them had some customers that they worked with already. You know, and they wanted to kind of bring them on there and be able to sell to them, you know, through that platform as well.
Did that make you nervous?
A little bit. You know, back then there was a number of fairly public kind of online forums for this. You know, a number of them were kind of slowly disappearing. And I think, to be honest with you, that's one of the big reasons Dark Code grew to what it was, is that a lot of the other ones got shut down. It's also one of those things where the exclusivity, like the fact that it was invite only, actually made it really attractive to a lot of people. And so it became pretty popular pretty quickly. So in any case, we made the decision at some point, all right, we're going to bring in more than just programmers. And there was some effort to kind of divide the site a little bit, like, you know, make some of the sections private. You know, we don't want all the script kiddies who are buying our stuff to read all our secrets, you know. And that part grew pretty quickly. Certainly, it's been my experience that the number of people using these tools is a much larger community than the ones making them. It's a much smaller number of people who are actually, you know, developing this software.
And would a buyer sort of say, this is what I'm looking for, and this is what I'm willing to pay, and this is what I want to do with it, and you would almost act like a consultant?
There was a little bit of that, but in a lot of cases it was the opposite. You know, people had, programmers had this bot that they've created, and they actually market it. So, you know, they'd post a thread in the forum, and they'd give it some kind of clever name. I've got some horribly embarrassing names that I chose over the years that I'm not going to mention. But you know, they'd put together a little sales pitch, screenshots, in some cases, you know, they'd even offer demonstrations if you wanted, you know, trial software. I find it kind of ironic in a way that a lot of these guys creating this stuff put a lot of effort into, like, protecting their IP. Like, they actually are using, you know, like, software protection stuff to make sure that people aren't, you know, ripping off their botnet software and using it for free, which I think there's some irony there.
And so how much money, I know you didn't make very much money, but how much money are we talking about as Dark Code started to grow in those first couple of years? What, the most successful person on Dark Code, what kind of money were they making?
Well, you know, at the time, I think the most successful person was the other co-founder, Zerto. He was marketing a product that he called Butterfly Bot. It's more commonly known as the Mariposa botnet, if you've heard of that. Had some real unique technologies in it, unique at the time anyway, some innovative things. And he sold quite a bit of that pretty brazenly. You know, at one point, outside of Dark Code, he even had put up a public website where you could, like, click to buy, you know, no login required. It's kind of crazy. But, you know, I don't recall exactly what he was selling it for, but it was somewhere on the order of, you know, $1,000, $2,000 or something like that per license, and he was selling it to, you know, dozens, you know, or perhaps hundreds of people over a couple years there. You know.
And what did the Butterfly Bot actually do? I know it's a famous one, but what did it actually do?
You know, I don't know the exact feature list off the top of my head, but, you know, I think it was a lot of the same. You know, collect system information, denial of service. It had some capabilities to spread to other machines. I think in particular that one had the capability to infect USB drives that you plug into a computer. So if you take, you know, a flash drive, plug it into your computer, that's already infected. The flash drive would get infected. You go plug it in somewhere else, and now that one's infected. That was kind of a popular technique in that time. Since it's become a little bit harder to do that, though, it's still not unheard of. So that was one of the features. I think it had a lot of the standard stuff, you know, denial of service. It had the capability to collect passwords, you know, things that were saved in your web browser, you know, logins for sites, that kind of thing. It wasn't, I don't believe, like the advanced kind of banking malware that you see, like with Zeus. You know, it wasn't kind of intercepting banking transactions and collecting all that information.
And so would people just put in their credit card number? Is that how they would pay for it?
No, you know, you can't really use a credit card to buy things like that.
Well, that's why I was wondering.
I think as someone marketing that software, you'd probably have trouble finding a payment processor willing to provide those services for you. But, you know, over the years, the payment methods varied a lot. You know, now, of course, Bitcoin's very popular, but, you know, in 2008, 2009, that was not the case. People used e-passports and a number of these services that are very similar to PayPal, actually, but a lot of them are, you know, not based in the U.S. There's a few based in Russia that were really popular. So they provide some level of anonymity in any case. I mean,
although that's sort of how you got caught.
That is, right? How I got caught.
Okay.
Certainly. So the financial trail. You know, that's it's a real problem for people trying to do this. Is that you know, even in the case of Bitcoin now, you know, Bitcoin is fairly anonymous, right? But you know, if you're exchanging Bitcoins with someone, but that's really only useful if you're buying kind of digital services and goods. You know, at some point, if you want to get money out into the real world, you want to buy a house, you know, with your ill-gotten gains, you've got to turn that into cash, and there's not a lot of ways to do that don't create a real paper trail.
So explain how you got caught, when you got caught, and what that was like.
Yeah, so, you know, I got caught for selling malware that I had created. So the gentleman that I sold it to was an FBI agent or a CI. I'm not entirely clear on that. But, you know, they caught me through the money trail, you know, how I was paid for it. You know, the same problem I was just describing. You got to get the money out somehow. And though in fairness, you know, I did not put much effort into my money laundering. Perhaps that's arrogance. I didn't think I'd get caught. I don't know, but you know, I don't think it was too hard for the FBI to find me.
So when you made this transaction, did you know sort of in your heart, you kind of went, I wonder if there's something goofy about this, or did it seem perfectly normal and then...
No, to be honest, it didn't strike me that way at the time. You know, the guy I... did the deal with did not really set off any alarm bells for me. So
what did?
Well, the FBI kicking down my door, that was alarming.
I know the story a little bit. A lot of people find the FBI kicking down their door alarming. So you were living at home at the time. Do you want to describe? You were living with your parents, I think, right?
I was living with my parents at the time, and yes, I'll get out of the way. I was the stereotypical hacker living in his parents' basement. I know it's like a bad joke, but it's true. And so that they showed up. I should be fair. They didn't kick down the door. They were actually very polite.
Knocked.
No flashbangs or anything like that. Uh-huh. But
who came to the door? Did your mom or your dad? Or?
I believe it was my mother. I was asleep at the time. It was
daytime.
No, it was
just... sorry.
Fair enough. No, it was very early in the morning, 5 or 6 a.m., which is a time of day that I only ever see if I haven't gone to sleep yet. So I was asleep at the time, and you know, but I kind of heard them, but before I saw them and announcing who they were. And
And did your mother sort of call down to the basement and say, Daniel, there's some people here to see you? Or?
Well, I was not in the basement. I was in my bedroom at the time, which was not in the same location. But, yeah, you know, my parents, as you might imagine, were not particularly happy with me that day. they did not find any amusement in it whatsoever.
Were you led away in handcuffs and the whole bit?
Yes, I wasn't actually arrested that day, but I was briefly in handcuffs. I don't recommend it if you haven't experienced it. I could have gone without that experience.
Were you scared? Did you know exactly what they had you on? What went through your head?
Yeah, I mean, you know, given what I was involved in, I had a pretty good idea. I mean, I at the time, of course, didn't know specifically how they had caught me, but, you know... I don't think many people who have the FBI show up at their door are surprised when it happens. I mean, they're surprised, but you know,
they're
not
know
questioning
why they're
there.
And I should be clear that up until that time, you really had no trouble with the law. So it wasn't like this was the first of many visits from law enforcement
no,
at your house.
No, I was, you know, not a habitual law breaker by any means. Well, shouldn't say that. Obviously, I broke a lot of laws, but I did not have a lot of contact with law enforcement. You know, really did not have many troubles of that kind in my youth, other than this.
And this was 2010.
That was in 2010. Yes, so spring 2010 is when that happened. Spent the rest of that day being questioned. I did kind of opt at that time to be cooperative. I didn't see any reason not to, and certainly at that point they had seized my computers, which I knew full well had plenty of supporting evidence of my activities. I was at the time using technology called TrueCrypt. It's a disk encryption technology, but was not very good about my OPSEC, if you will, in that I had left my computer logged in, which means, of course, they were able to recover the keys and all that. So that certainly did nothing to help me.
Did you hire a lawyer?
That day, no. I did not have representation that day, but I did later. I have been represented the whole time by Michael Best and Friedrich in Milwaukee. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they were very good.
And you ended up, and I don't know how much you can talk about this, you ended up sort of being, well, let me back up for a second. We were talking outside, and you said that you felt like the way most of these things were broken up or the way people were caught was either a confidential informant or the financial trail. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've had a fair amount of interaction with the FBI over the last few years, and certainly don't know everything about how they work on the inside, but you know, one of the observations I had in both my case and a lot of the ones that I had any information about was that a lot of these, and this kind of surprised me as somebody who's an IT person, is that a lot of these cases are at least initially created based on confidential informants and on financial trails, which makes a lot of sense now in retrospect, but initially. What did I do wrong from a technology aspect? What trail did I leave? And it wasn't about that. And certainly I think a lot of that technical evidence creates great supporting evidence. Certainly the things that they collected from my computer did a lot to support the rest of it. But it was kind of fascinating to me that those were kind of the avenues.
Were there other people taken down at the same time as you were? Or were you?
Not as far as I know. My incident was kind of standalone. Dark Code itself was not really taken down until this last summer 2015. A number of people were arrested at that time.
And you were named in that complaint?
I was named in that complaint. The took a very long time to resolve my case. So I was actually charged at pretty much the same time as all those other people in 2015, and finally got kind of resolution on my case in December 2015, so very recently even, even though I was originally caught back in 2010.
And what were you doing between 2010 and 2015?
Yeah, so right out of the gate, right after this happened, my parents... I won't say they kicked me out, but they assisted me with a rapid move out. The main reason for that was that, my father is also kind of employed in the field in IT, and, unfortunately, being the dumb kid that I was, that put him in an awkward position, which I really regret. But there was a desire there to kind of create some distance. So I moved out, and initially I ended up very briefly working in landscaping, which was something that I had done in the past. But pretty quickly I got a job doing some network wiring, so network cabling for buildings. And in fact, I worked a lot in institutions similar to this, schools, pulling cabling. And that quickly transitioned into a more technical IT position. I started doing... like networking and voice over IP, and that's what I've been doing for the last 5 years. I'm employed at a small company in Milwaukee, doing consulting, so networking, phone systems, which are very much tied together now.
And when you see these different hacking cases, and do you sort of analyze them and go, I understand what it is that they were doing or how they did it, that sort of thing? I mean, do you have sort of a professional eye to these cases?
Yeah, you know, I certainly keep up on tech news, including security news. What I currently do isn't necessarily security focused, although it's certainly a component of it. But I definitely do keep up on things that are happening, and I do read those cases with interest. And in a few cases, I've read these articles of people that I used to know who have since gotten caught. So that's always been interesting to read, and it's interesting to find out a little bit more about them too. A lot of these people, they're kind of nameless and faceless. You have their alias. Even someone that maybe I talked to for a couple of years, which is a pretty long relationship. Still never met them in person. You don't have a face to put to it. You don't know like really who they were, or where they're from. Obviously, very protective of that information. In my years of being involved in this stuff, I only ever actually met one of the people that I knew online in person.
And what was that like?
It was interesting. I didn't know what to expect going into it, and I think I had a lot of the same feelings that people might have now about like online dating. Even I'm going to meet this person that I met on the internet. Like, what if there's some serial killer? So it was interesting, but it turned out he was a young guy. I think even a couple years younger than me, living in a suburb of Chicago, Aurora, I believe. So it was an hour and a half drive, from Milwaukee. And
I mean, did he say, "Hey, let's meet up"? I mean, how did it come
about?
Yeah,
I mean, we had I don't remember the specifics, but we had been talking for a number of years and kind of involved in some things together. So it's like, hey, at some point we had found out that we lived pretty close together. Let's meet up for a day and hang out and chat. And it's probably irrelevant, but it just, for whatever reason, this memory sticks with me. We went to see Alien versus Predator that day. But he was a surprisingly regular guy. Maybe that sounds weird coming from me, but he was, I think at that point he was a senior in high school or his first year in college, very nerdy like me. He was a little bit more on the business side than the programming side. He had some programming skills, but he was actually running, a botnet and, making some real money off it. I believe this particular gentleman has since been caught. He was actually one of the people who was running Dark Code after I left. So.
And so lunch conversation was about Dark Code and the business problems that that he was having, or?
This was, I believe, pre-Dark Code, but, very briefly before it. But yeah, sat down, had lunch, kind of talked shop.
And as Dark Code developed, did you have any sort of pangs, like, I helped create this thing that's becoming much more of a illicit marketplace than what I had in mind when I started
over the last
it?
5 years?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, definitely, and I regret a lot of the poor decisions I made, and at the time, it was easy to kind of not see all the risk, not see necessarily the victims, in what I was doing, and it really didn't hit me until later. I think it started to hit me, a little bit the day I got caught, but it really took some reflection to see that, wow, this I was just goofing around on the internet, and I was just writing code. That's something you can tell yourself. Well, I was only writing the code, but that's not entirely true. I knew what these people were doing with it. I knew what was going on. So, coming to that realization. Seeing what I had created here certainly wasn't a pleasant feeling.
And what do you think when you see online black markets now? What's your reaction to it? How do you see them developing in coming years?
Well, I think thanks to our friends at the FBI that they are going to be increasingly underground. I think they're going to be harder and harder to get into. We've already, of course, seen that. In the last few years here, if you go back 5-10 years, this stuff was It's very brazen. I mean, you didn't need to know anyone. You could just Google it, find the site, sign up, and start buying things, start playing with this code. It was easy to find, which isn't to say you can't find it now, but you know, certainly the more you know, exclusive sites, the sites that the groups that are attracting the really good programmers, the people who are really good at creating this stuff, have been driven, you know, pretty far underground, and I think are going to continue to do so.
Do you get to use your programming skills now?
A little bit. You know, my current employment is not a programming job, but you know, certainly from a scripting and automation standpoint, that can play into what I do a little bit. You know, sometimes I miss it. I still do some programming, you know, as kind of a hobby, nothing major. But, you know, I think, as with a lot of hobbies, doing it professionally can maybe take away some of the magic. And, you know, I certainly, you know, given what I was programming all those years, perhaps hasn't been a bad thing to kind of unplug from that and pursue other things.
Okay. So I wanted to open it up to questions. And, yeah. Go ahead.
I'm Steve Abdullah. I'm a resident here in Austin. What's your opinion, Mr. Plaisack, about the burgering industry and hacking, where 4,500 companies are paying people to hack into the system, even if they're well protected? Isn't that kind of increasing hacking, legally and illegally?
So are you talking like penetration testing or like bug bounty?
Both.
Both. I think it's a really good idea. You know, I can tell you. You know, from an attacker's perspective, there's often a lot of things that you know, that attackers are doing that don't necessarily align with what people are doing to defend. So I think you know, getting that insight into, you know, somebody really truly trying, you know, and perhaps succeeding to break in, gives you some real scenarios on how could this actually happen instead of just guessing at it. You know, it's funny to hear people talk about all these really advanced exploitation techniques or advanced, you know, methods of breaking into these networks. It's been my experience, you know, being involved in this, that the bulk majority of serious security compromises are actually laughably stupid. They're really, really bad. I mean, bad passwords, ancient software, you know, passwords reused in 1,000 different places. You know, it's... In some cases, a lot of these hacks are not as complicated as you think they would be. And certainly, like, penetration testing and bug bounty type programs can really help you find a lot of that low-hanging fruit very quickly, but certainly some of the more complex attacks, too.
Ben?
So as somebody who has been both a target of surveillance, and it sounds like a very justified target, I'm interested in your thoughts on the
going
dark
debate. Yeah, I think it's a very interesting discussion. You know, I'm very pro encryption. You know, I will say, and maybe this will be surprising coming from someone like me, but I very much understand the feelings from law enforcement that, you know, they want some method to get some of this data. You know, you look at even crimes that are completely unrelated to technology. I mean, even if we're talking, let's just say murder, you know, access to cell phones and computers can certainly play a big part of that. So, you know, certainly if a significant amount of our infrastructure, if our phones and our computers and all that starts becoming encrypted by default, you know, with no intervention required by the end user, that I can understand from law enforcement's perspective why that's kind of scary. But I think the other side to that, and, you know, my biggest concern is not so much law enforcement. Is I forget who was sitting in the end here yesterday, but they were talking about, you know, this whole sexual exploitation thing. People taking pictures with, was that you? People taking pictures with webcams and then using that as leverage. And I think that right there is a really good demonstration of the kind of power you can get over someone with this kind of surveillance. And I find that kind of scary, not even necessarily so much in the hands of law enforcement as, you know, some of the other agencies or foreign countries, and what that could mean. You know, you look historically at, you know, some of the people in the past who have been able to collect large swaths of information on people and use that for blackmail, you know, even in some of our own government's history. And that's given them a lot of power over a lot of people. So I think it's scary, you know, especially in the case of like the NSA, to have so much power concentrated in a relatively small number of people and what they could do with that information. And I'm not sure how you solve that. I mean, that's really hard, you know. People use the word backdoor encryption. That's a tough problem too. If you look at kind of the history of backdoored or deliberately weakened encryption systems, you know, those keys have never really been kept secret. You know, it's always enabled other parties besides, you know, the attendant party to access it too. So, I mean, that's kind of tough. You know, a real world example that I find hilarious, and not to pick on the government here, but I don't know if any of you saw this story, but I think it was the director of the TSA. I'm not sure exactly what his title was, but he went on TV at some point, and I don't remember what he was speaking about, but he held up a copy of the key that opens all the suitcases for those special TSA locks. And people took that recording and 3D printed a copy of that key just from it being on TV. And just kind of a real-world example of the problem with you know, secret keys that the government holds. So,
other questions? Yes.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, what motivated you. I mean, I can imagine a combination of economic gain, just a puzzle, kind of solve a puzzle. But when you were in more involved in doing the program, what got you up from there?
Yeah, you know, initially, you know, at first, money did not even enter my mind. You know, for the first little while there, it wasn't even. I didn't even think, oh, I could make money from this. It was really more of an intellectual curiosity. It's like, how does this stuff work? You know, how can I change it? So that's really what got me started initially. You know, later on, you know, certainly I did do it for monetary gain. Like I said, I was not good at that part. But, you know, I think that was more a consequence of, you know, hey, this is consuming a lot of my time, and I can make a little bit of money, and then I can kind of justify it consuming my time, more so than, oh, I'm going to become a millionaire doing this. You know, there certainly are some people who have become millionaires doing it, but you know, that was not my path.
How much time do we have, Bobby?
If we can go to the top of the hour, if there are more questions.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, you know, that's actually, you know, a really hard topic. I can't remember who I was talking with someone about that yesterday, yeah. I believe. It was. Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting. It's all blurring together. But, you know, and the comparison was made to, you know, teenagers that are at risk for, like, gang activity. And, you know, I like that comparison, but the problem with it is that, you know, I think it's a lot easier to identify people who are at risk for that type of thing, that type of crime. You know, it tends to be localized to a specific area, whereas, you know, people like myself are pretty far spread, and I think identifying them is a little bit harder. You know, I would say we're certainly not all the same, but I will tell you in my experience, at least as far as Americans go, you know, a lot of us are male, young, you know, get into it in our mid or late teens, and, you know, perhaps, you know, get better at it in our early 20s. There are not a lot of people from the older generations involved in this, at least from what I've observed.
And do you think that you may not have been as attracted to it if you had a different outlet? Say, for example, when you went to high school, there was a teacher who was good at Python who said, look, you're beyond what these kids are doing. Let's do something else together. Do
you absolutely. Think that- absolutely. I think that's probably, you know, one of the things, the biggest things that we could do is provide a route for an education for some of these people who have really strong computer skills at a young age and have an interest in it to develop those kind of earlier. You know, a lot of the things that I was dabbling in are just not available in education until you reach the college level. So
you found something to do with your skills?
Unfortunately, yeah.
We should say that you have been sentenced only as of December, and
yes,
you got 2 years probation and community service. Is that right?
I did, yes. 100 hours community service. The judge asked me to serve my community service with MPS. That's the local school district. So perhaps relevant to your question, I can do something for that. That has yet to take form, so we'll see. But I was charged with conspiracy to access a computer without authorization under 1030. So, and it was a misdemeanor. Fortunately for me, I think that situation worked out pretty well for me. I think certainly in my case anyway, cooperating with the government was a good move for me, and certainly has helped get my life back on track. I'm in a much better place now than I was 6 or 7 years ago.
Among other things, you're married to your girlfriend.
Yes, married now. No kids. So, and now that I, have this case behind me, I think we'll be looking at a house. So I'm excited for that.
Maybe without a basement.
I don't think that's avoidable in Wisconsin, but
also an attic.
Mr. Jen.
So, there's obviously a vibrant discussion about how to fix the internet so that this kind of stuff can't go on, whether it's biometric sign-on or another layer of internet, which is more secure. Have you thought much about how to either change the structure of the internet so that this kind of thing can't go on, or change something about access to the internet such that it's easier to prevent? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, quite a bit. I think the freedom that we have on the internet right now is really valuable, and I think it's hard to have solutions to that problem without taking away from that freedom. In my mind, the very first place to attack, this problem, like malware and botnets especially, is really on the software side. I think Microsoft, for example, plays a really big role in that, and I have to give props to them too. Certainly, Windows has come a long way since Windows XP from a security standpoint. It's improved with every version, and it's gotten much better with Windows 10 too. Though I do have some problems with their privacy standpoint with Windows 10. But, really, I think it's a problem that we have to fix on the software side. Unfortunately, software is this ever-expanding thing. If you look at these applications, these operating systems that we use today, there are just millions and millions of lines of code. It's just unfathomable amounts of code. And that makes it very difficult to kind of audit and verify those systems. And I think in a lot of cases, many of these companies don't take it seriously. Fixing security bugs or fixing bugs in general is secondary to pushing features out the door. And, how we incentivize them to change, from a law and policy perspective, I don't know. But I think, somehow we got to create some real incentive for companies to actually invest in security, especially on the software side.
So I hope you'll join me in thanking Daniel for giving sort of human shape and form to all of this. Thank you very much. Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the University of Texas at Austin's Strauss Center for permission to use this audio. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan, and as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare Podcast via your social networks, Twitter, Facebook, email, and in any other way you can. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.